I got started on this basically because I felt that there was a story to be told about the place that these games had taken in our culture, especially as today we see video games commanding sales figures that are the envy of major Hollywood studios. To be able to trace back the origins of the technologies, of the settings, of the ideas that have created this new, vibrant, and actually quite significant aspect of American culture. I didn't think anybody had really taken that on previously, and that's what I took on.
Let's talk about the specific instances that came together to make Dungeons and Dragons such a game changer when it came out in the early 1970s.
First of all, you have to appreciate that this was a time when Tolkien had just really was at the crest of monumental popularity as an author. Tolkien's works had become available in inexpensive paperback editions for the first time in the mid-1960s. And once it became clear just how successful those were going to be, publishers brought all sorts of new fantasy fiction, new swords and sorcery things. The old Conan yarns, which had originally been published in the 1930s, were brought back into print then as well. And so one of the things that Dungeons & Dragons did was it took a category of gaming that had been kind of a niche sort of game. This was called war gaming. This is mostly historical simulations that were played out on boards that let you refight the Battle of Gettysburg, say, or the Battle of D-Day. It took the principles of simulating conflict from those war games and tried to apply them to the fantasy world. And in so doing, it also combined into this an idea of character, an idea that each player was going to have kind of a surrogate in the game. And this was a very transformative breakthrough. They made this something about you and the personal progression of your character in the game.
Who were the earliest players of Dungeons and Dragons?
So the two fellows who created Dungeons & Dragons were Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson. And Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson both came out of this wargaming community. They had both been hobbyists since the mid-1960s.
And what part of the country are we talking about?
They're both Midwesterners. So Dave Arneson grew up in St. Paul in the Twin Cities. Gary Gygax was based in the town of Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, which is a resort town about 2 hours north of Chicago that at the time was really just famous as being a place for well-heeled folks from Chicago to go in the summer in their nice summer homes kind of along the lake. But today, I think actually Lake Geneva, Wisconsin is famous mostly for being the birthplace of Dungeons & Dragons. Gary and Dave met at a convention called Gen Con. This is actually a very famous wargaming convention that Gary Gygax founded in 1968. It was called the Lake Geneva War Games Convention, or the Geneva Convention for short, or for even shorter, it became Gen Con. Gen Con still goes on today, though now we do it in Indianapolis, not in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. They first met there in 1969, and at that time, they were both already working on wargaming rules. The first set of wargaming rules they were interested in working on together was actually a set of naval rules for the Napoleonic era. So a pretty niche dimension of this. But in 1971, Gary published a medieval fantasy wargame called Chainmail. Chainmail popped a lot of monocles from the eyes of people in the wargaming community who had really taken wargames as something very serious. We're doing historical simulation, and what's this of bringing in dragons and orcs and ents and balrogs and all that and making that a part of wargames? People said it was childish, it was very controversial, but among younger wargamers, it was extremely compelling. And Dave Arneson was one of the first to kind of connect up with Chainmail and begin to adapt and expand it, and it was in his play in the Twin Cities that he came up with the idea that maybe rather than just having these forces be fighting out in the middle of a battlefield with a massive army, instead you could have small tactical groups that were exploring an underground space like a dungeon and would fight monsters there and get their loot and come back out. And it was when Dave showed that prototype to Gary that this was late in 1972, that they began collaborating on the Dungeons & Dragons rules.
So what would you say were the key events, though, that turned this from a niche part of the gaming community into a really big business?
There's a certain irony in the story of how D&D went from being something that a few hobbyists, these people in the wargaming community or fans of fantasy fiction, played largely in college campuses, to how this became a mainstream phenomenon. It's actually a famous story, but a story that is widely misunderstood. And it's the story of a kid named James Dallas Egbert. James Dallas Egbert disappeared from a university in Michigan in the summer of 1979. And his parents hired a private investigator to try to find out what had happened to their son. So that this guy came to the James Dallas Egbert's dorm room, went through his possessions, and found copies of Dungeons and Dragons. And he'd never heard of it before because virtually no one had outside of these very insular communities that were interested in these games. And so he started asking questions about the university, about how people played D&D. And he got a variety of information, some of which seems plausible, some of which seems rather suspect, to my ears anyway. But he became fixated on the notion that James Dallas Egbert had begun to play a live-action version of D&D in the steam tunnels beneath the university because he had, apparently the game had warped his mind, and he believed it was real. And he was down in these steam tunnels, and he may be injured or just terribly confused, and that he absolutely needed to be found. For various reasons, though, the university was reluctant to let Deere search the steam tunnels, and because of that, Deere, the private investigator, he went to the media, and just day after day, you know, propounded this theory that James Dallas Egbert had gone insane because of this game, Dungeons and Dragons, and was lost under the steam tunnels at the university. And this became front page news on the New York Times and the San Francisco Chronicle. This was, you know, on nightly television broadcasts. And this was the first place most people in the world heard of D&D. It was this cult game. Cult was used a lot in the headlines for this, that would make you lose touch with reality. Now, it turned out this was entirely fatuous, based on a completely misguided hunch. In fact, this kid had run away, was in Louisiana. A couple weeks later, he turned himself in, and the reasons for his disappearance had nothing to do with D&D whatsoever. But, you know, the media being what it is, that wasn't the story that ended up in the headlines, right? The retractions didn't really get the same attention that some of these earlier and more sensational claims had gotten. But as a consequence of this, this very nerdy, niche game got something it couldn't have gotten any other way, this kind of dangerous reputation, this like rebellious cachet. And this caused more teenagers to buy D&D than anything else could, any amount of marketing money that TSR, the company that published D&D, could have mustered on their own. And so although it was based on this phenomenal misunderstanding, that's certainly what got it into the public eye and began the D&D fad, when you would see D&D going from making, as it did in, say, 1978 to 79, $1 million a year, to by 1983 to 84, $30 million a year.
Paint a little picture for us of how omnipresent Dungeons & Dragons was at the height of its success.
There really was a fad for Dungeons & Dragons, again, that lasted, I'd say, from 79, from the time that it was front page news in the New York Times, you know, up to really the release of Trivial Pursuit. If you look at what ended up displacing Dungeons and Dragons from the display stands at the front of Walden Books and B. Dalton, companies that, of course, are no longer with us, you know, it was games like Trivial Pursuit that kind of took it the place of it as a fad.
But what about computers coming in and the idea that you could suddenly play a game without having to do so much math?
There's no doubt that D&D requires a lot of number crunching, and it's actually very difficult to adjudicate combat fairly by D&D rules. And in fact, as you get into higher level characters, more powerful monsters, it's effectively impossible for humans to execute the system fairly. You always make some kinds of mistakes when you try to do D&D. And so certainly computer games provided a convenience that role-playing games really lacked. I mean, both in the sense that they did the system for you, but they also provided they provided a substitute for a gaming group for those times when it wasn't convenient for you to get one. And, you know, this is in some respects one of the real hurdles to doing tabletop role-playing, is you've got to find some like-minded people who are going to sit around a table with you and commit to do this regularly, and they're going to have to be people who are interested in the same kinds of stories that you are. But, of course, the flip side of that is that that's also what makes tabletop gaming so vital even today, is that it's really an opportunity for you and a small group of other people to invent and to believe in an adventure that's entirely, you know, of your own creation. And it only has to please those five people that are sitting around that table. Nobody else has to think it's a good idea. And that artisanal component to it, tabletop role-playing provides a real counterbalance to that that keeps it something that people want to do.
That was John Peterson. His book is Playing at the World: A History of Simulating Wars, People, and Fantastic Adventures from Chess to Role-Playing Games.